For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
Okay, welcome back. Nice to see you all again. Okay, tonight's going to be part two of the class that we in effect started last week, the False Messiahs. Last week we focused a great deal on Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi, who in the 1600s declared himself to be the Messiah, and really got the entire Jewish world excited about it. There were those in favor, many were against, but he had created a movement, he had created a religion, because part of what we discussed last week, and again we're going to get back to that a little bit this week, is because the Messiah has come, the rules have changed. Laws which previously applied no longer apply. It was the purification of the mundane, and he had changed the way that we practice Judaism, which is why when he became exposed as an apostate and he converted to Islam, just a few years, about 2 years after he openly revealed himself, he already became a Muslim. So it was a very short time in which he was out there as the Messiah, but the reverberations of what he caused really lasted for a century. That century is what we're going to discuss, God willing, tonight. The notes that I have for you are different than usual. Usually I'm much more elaborate. I ended up with just a very brief outline, and those who want to take notes while I speak are welcome to do so, of course, but the notes are a little bit briefer than usual. I wanted to start with two things. The first thing I want to start with is a piece of the Gemara that I studied this morning. Whenever you're learning something on your own and it relates perfectly to what it is that you're dealing with elsewhere in life, it's always of note. So I started learning the tractate Megillah, which deals with all the laws of Purim. On Shabbos we began the month of Adar, the first Adar, so we've got 6 weeks left to Purim. So I started, I took out the tractate Megillah, and as I try to do every year, get as much as I can. This morning I was trying to cover some ground, and I came across the following passage in the Gemara. The Gemara says, it's talking about the translations of the Torah. You're familiar, when you look at your stone Chumash, you'll see, of course, the Hebrew, and then you have the Aramaic, the small little print on the side, and then the English on the other side of the page. Who wrote that Aramaic translation? So it's the translation of Unkelus. Unkelus, who was a convert to Judaism, wrote that translation. The Gemara talks about that, and then it says, not only was the Torah, the five books of Moshe, translated, was it Meturgam, but the Tanakh as well. And the books of the Navi, the Gemara says, were translated by Yonasan ben Uziel. And the Gemara records that when Yonasan ben Uziel translated the books of the Navi, the Gemara says, Nizdazo Eretz Yisrael arba meos parso al arba meos parso. The land of Israel shuddered throughout the entire length and breadth of the land of Israel. Yosef the Baskol, and a heavenly voice came out and said, Mi hu zeh shegila sisrai livnei adam. Who revealed my secrets to flesh and blood, to human beings? By translating the words of the Navi, revealing the difficult passages, who is it that did so? Who revealed those secrets? So Yonasan ben Uziel stands up, the Gemara says, and says, it was me. I'm the one who did it. I didn't do it for my own honor. I didn't do it for the glory of my father's household. I did it for you, he says, in order that there shouldn't be disputes amongst the Jewish people, because there are passages in the Navi which are unclear. So instead of leaving it that way, where everyone understands it differently, so I have revealed the heavenly secrets as to the correct understanding of all the words of Tanakh, of the Navi. The Gemara then continues, Bikesh Legalos Targum Shel Ksuvim. He did so well with the Navi, the books of the prophets, he began and set out to translate the books of the writings. As you recall from our Tanakh B'Shana, we have the five books of Moshe, we have the books of the prophets, and then we have the books of the writings. And he began to do so. Yotu Sabasko V'amru Lo Dayacha. Heavenly voice calls out and says, no more. We've revealed Torah, we've revealed the prophets, the writings will remain hidden. We can have a translation into English, but the meanings hidden from us. Why, says the Gemara? Why shouldn't we know? Any guesses what the Gemara says? That's exactly right. The Gemara says, why? Mishum de ispe kates Mashiach. Because buried in the words of the writing, particularly Rashi says, the book of Daniel is the revelation as to when the end will be. And therefore, let it be that all the books of the writings will have phrases and ideas that we're not sure about. It's worth it, says the heavenly court, because the other alternative is we'll know when the end is. And we may not know when that end will be. That was this morning is what I studied. And that's literally what we're doing last week, tonight, is this burning desire of the Jewish people to know, to predict, to calculate, to yearn, to experience. And it is divinely ordained. We will not know until it happens. We just don't know. And we won't know. That's number one. Number two that I want to start with is, if you recall, last week I told you a story of Rabbi Yaakov Sesportis, who took up arms against Shabtai Tzvi and wrote letters to all of his colleagues and tried to quell the swelling of excitement. And one of the letters that he wrote was to his colleague Rabbi Yitzchak Abuav and asked, why aren't you stopping them? So I wanted to tell the story. I spoke in Shalosh Shudis to the kids, 6th, 7th, and 8th graders, Shalosh Shudis downstairs. So I wanted to tell them that story and get some feedback and talk about it a little bit with them. And I began by saying, put yourself back into the 1600s. What would we do today before we, like, what would be if someone came and introduced themselves and said, I'm the Mashiach? So if you recall when I did this with you last week, I said the first thing we would do is, that's right, very good, excellent. Then we'd Google him, we'd find, like, who is this guy? Where has he been? Where did he get his smicha from? Where did he get his degrees from? Where does he live? Who is he? Mashiach's not just going to pop out of thin air. We should have a record of him, because everybody's got a record online these days. So we would Google him. So that was, so I asked the boys that question, like, well, what would you do if someone came and said he's Mashiach, so expecting that kind of answer or wanting? And the boys sort of said, well, we'd call him crazy. It was so fascinating that in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, without having classes on Shabtai Tzvi, which they haven't, it's just permeated, it's become part of the culture. Anyone who gets up and says, I'm Mashiach, it's a given to a 6th, 7th, or 8th grader, hey, he's a nutcase. And what a fascinating, like, that's a result of what we're learning. It's a result, it's just part of the way that we speak, it's part of our culture, we don't accept it. We simply don't accept it. There's a phrase in Yiddish, which I'm not even going to attempt to say in Yiddish, and I'm not going to do justice to the translation, but the phrase goes along the lines of, a mouth which is burnt by scalding hot water will blow even when it's cold. And that's the Jewish people and Mashiach. That's it. It doesn't matter if it's cold. It doesn't matter if it's got ice. We're going to blow. Because we were burned once, and we were burned bad. And therefore, there's this... like, no one taught these sixth graders to say that. It's just, we know that. Anyone who says Mashiach, forget it. Now, in a way, this is good for the Jewish people. Because we're so weary of it. We're so hesitant to believe. When it happens, it will be hand-down convincing. I am sure of it. Because there's a, part of the greatness of Mashiach is going to convince us that he's the Mashiach. Because we have put up massive, you know, force fields around ourselves. And as much as we say, yeah, Mashiach comes, he's going to fix that. Mashiach comes, he'll fix that. Everyone likes to say, the reason why Mashiach hasn't come is because we've heaped so much stuff on him. He's got to fix this problem, and he's got to fix that problem, and this. Who wants that job? When he comes, it will be convincing. Because we are not willing to go along with that. And we have paid a heavy, heavy price to get us where we are. And that's what we're going to be discussing tonight, the heavy price that we paid and what lessons that we have to learn from them. So with that, let us begin. What we're going to talk about are four events. Well, most of them will be, two or three of them will be rather quickly, but four basic events, responses, reactions to Shabtai Tzvi. 1650s is where he's already becoming an apostate. We're in that area. This is going to go on until 1750 and then beyond. Literally over 125 years, we're going to deal with the ramifications of Shabtai Tzvi. Now there are two, all the events are manifestations of two responses to Shabtai Tzvi. They are diametrically opposed, but very, very strong responses to Shabtai Tzvi. On the one hand, is the response which I think we would more predict or expect, and that is going on a witch hunt with a vengeance to uproot any semblance, any remembrance, any aspect of Shabtai Tzviism which existed. You remember, it sweeps the Jewish world. There are entire communities which are preparing to move to the land of Israel, selling their goods, fighting back against the Christians. It was a powerful movement, and now when it's been exposed to be a farce, it's not true. The innovations that he introduced are not really Jewish. He himself became an apostate. So there was a response of fierce witch hunting, fierce uprooting, and getting rid of every last remnant of anything to do with Shabtai Tzvi. That was one response which we're going to see. And I think the more expected response. There was a second response which defies almost all logic. And that is a response of significant numbers of the Jewish people who held on as fiercely as before to the idea that Shabtai Tzvi is indeed the Mashiach. And that belief will maintain itself for well over 100 years after Shabtai Tzvi is an apostate, after he dies. 100 years, you're talking almost 3 generations. This one's parents and another generation continues to believe that the Mashiach had indeed come. And that is very hard to explain. Shabtai Tzvi dies, Nathan of Gaza dies, his original followers all die, and the movement maintains itself. It continues. I want to share with you, I have two sources that I used in preparing for this class that I share with you if you'd like, that they're just fascinating. One is from a dissertation that was written by Rabbi J.J. Schachter, who is a professor rabbi now in YU and elsewhere. I almost got him here to teach one of the classes for this, but it was too difficult to work out. He wrote a dissertation from Harvard University for his PhD. A dissertation is probably the wrong word. It's a 750-page piece of work on Rabbi Yaakov Emden, who we're going to be speaking about at great length tonight. So within those 750 pages, there's about 100 to 150 dedicated to the controversy, the Rabbi Yaakov Emden, Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz controversy that we're going to talk about tonight. So I use that as a great source. It's online. Harvard University's got it all. You Google it and call it, and it's a PDF. If you want to go through all 750 pages, it's very fascinating. He did a tremendous amount of research, and it was very, very valuable. And there's another article written by Rabbi Dr. Sid Lyman, Schneer Lyman, who also was here as a scholar in residence last year, who's a professor at Brooklyn University and elsewhere. And he also has had a great focus in his work on Rabbi Yaakov Emden as well in this particular controversy. And he wrote an interesting article because there was some new evidence that was dug up recently about the controversy, I'll get to in a moment, in a few moments. And so he's written a number of articles as well. They're both available. If you want these direct sources, you can email me after the class. I'll send them right to you, and you don't have to spend your time searching. Fascinating reads about this period of our history. Within Rabbi Schachter's dissertation, so he quotes a lot from a historian named Gershon Sholem, who wrote a definitive work on Shabtai Tzvi and has a lot to speak about it. And he presents this as a question: how is it possible that this maintained itself for so long? It was false. He was an apostate. How did it happen that so many of what we'll learn about tonight continued it? So he presents the following idea, which I think is a value for us to be aware of, and that is as follows. There's sometimes a conflict, I guess in modern psychological terms we would call it cognitive dissonance, between what we know in our minds and what we feel and experience in our essence, in our inner being. The Jews who were around in the mid-1600s, who are coming off of the disasters you mentioned last week of Tach V'Tat, the Chalmiki uprising and the slaughtering of 200,000 Jews and all of the problems that had preceded that in the centuries before, and now Mashiach is here. And as we discussed last week, if you remember the response that Rabbi Yitzchak Abuhof wrote back to Rabbi Yaakov Sosportis, I should stop them? Jews are excited. Jews are coming to shul. They think the Messiah is here. Well, imagine if you were one of those Jews and the euphoric experience that you had, that all those years and centuries of suffering had come to an end, and you were going back home and you're going to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, and Tchiyas HaMeisim was around the corner. There was a euphoria, literally, which swept through the Jewish world. And then, pop. It's not true. So there's a massive test, so to speak, a very, very bitter choice that you have to make. You either have to say to yourself, all of those feelings, all of that excitement, the passion, I davened in a way like I've never davened in my entire life. I've been learning in a way that I've never been learning in my entire life. All my family members who have not been observant, everyone's coming to me for Shabbos. We have had the most glorious 3 months as a Jew ever. And then you find out that the man converted. The whole thing was a sham. And you have a very bitter choice to make. You either say, intellectually, I know it was fake. I was fooled and duped, and all my experiences, which might have been enlightening and exciting, but it was based on sheker, on falsehood. Or you say, it's impossible. That experience was so real. The passion, the excitement, the truth that I feel like I've experienced in Judaism, and I therefore have to reinterpret what I'm seeing around me as facts. And Sholem suggests that that bitter choice resulted in many, many, many Jews unable, unwilling to say, I've been duped. Because my experience is so real. My emotions are so real. It can't be that it's not true. And if you remember last week, we spoke about the concept of all those 7 little boxes that we had, which made this so difficult to deal with. One of which was the concept of Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. Chazal, the sages, were very vague about this dual process of the Messiah. What happens to Mashiach ben Yosef? He dies. And in that, he paves the way for Mashiach ben David. The whole concept of anything Kabbalistically inclined, we don't understand anyway. So, okay, so it doesn't make so much sense. But now I have my strong emotions, and I have something which doesn't make sense. But it's Kabbalistically inclined anyway. So, it's okay that it doesn't make sense. Not only is it okay that it doesn't make sense, maybe this is part of the test. As we spoke about, as Nathan of Gaza kept on saying last week. So you have now, following what we, looking back 350 years ago, we say, the man became a Muslim. He converted. He was a sham, so we look at it as, that's ridiculous. But if you were there at the time and you had packed your bags and sold your house and sold your business and you were excited, really, really, really excited, like you've never been before, and then one day you find out that the whole thing is a lie, you might not be so quick to say, yes, it's a lie, and you might be just as quick to say, maybe there's something else there. Maybe that's the Mashiach ben Yosef vague, unclear element of this. And what we're now going to discuss are the 4 episodes in which these are diametrically opposed reactions. The reaction of uproot every last element of this, get rid of it, search under every rock, anyone who has any ties to him, destroy it, on the one hand, versus all the Jews who felt this is really, it's still it. Don't give up hope. Don't give up that emotion. Don't give up the passion. Don't give up the excitement. And we're going in 2 very different directions as a response. And because I have to say this every week, we're about to enter into the worst century. It's really not true. It's really not. It's sort of true, but it's not true. It's the worst internal controversy in Jewish. That's for sure. In the last 300 years, there's no controversy that's going to destroy the Jewish people like what we're going to go through right now tonight. This Rabbi Yaakov Emden and Yonatan Eibishitz controversy is going to be the culmination of it, and it's going to just leave the Jewish people in shambles when it's done. And by the time this century of the 1700s finishes, and the Reform movement is on the horizon, and the Reformations in the secular world, and the Enlightenment comes in. When those movements sweep through the world, a Jewish people that are in shambles coming off of the 1700s, and the false messiahs, and the false hope, and the shattered dreams, and rabbis across the world fighting tooth and nail, are the source of the fractured Jewish world that we live in today. Source of the fact that over the last 200 years, the religious element of Judaism is a small minority of the Jewish people. Small minority. That never existed before. Either you're Jewish and you're in or you're left. But to be identified as a Jew, all of these realities that we live in are an outgrowth of the 1700s that we're about to do. So with that very exciting, enlightening, and happy introduction, so let us begin. Okay, immediately after his death, Shabtai Tzvi, that is, immediately after his death in, I believe it was 1676, he dies, 1680, Nathan of Gaza dies. There is a group of Jews in Turkey that for the Donme, I don't know if they were called the Donme, that's what they were referred to. It was actually led by Shabtai Tzvi's fourth wife. I mentioned to you that one of the things that Shabtai Tzvi and his movement did away with was the sexual morality that was a hallmark of Judaism, and all sorts of debauchery became accepted, and he had many, many wives, which was by Ashkenazic tradition by that point. Clearly, he happened to have been Sfar, but it was not generally done in most of the world, or certainly the Jewish world, by that point. And his fourth wife goes to Turkey and founds a group called the Donme. What they did is they believed that you had to behave exactly the same way as Shabtai Tzvi did, which was convert to Islam and maintain some ties to Judaism. This is a group that existed from the late 1600s all the way until the 1940s and 50s. You could look them up. That's why these are just fascinating. You look them up, you'll find a bunch of stuff on Wikipedia, on the internet about them. They were a group, they swelled in numbers. They were a group of Jews who converted. They adopted quasi-Muslim practices, quasi-Jewish practices. Their basic rules of life were was known in English as the 18 precepts, which was a variation of the 10 commandments. They noticed that they were known to say that the commandment of not to commit adultery was a suggestion to avoid problems as opposed to an actual law, because they were well known for wife swapping. That was part of one of the things that they did. And there were over 3,000 Jews who converted with her, and then another group that joins later. They were a significant number of Jews who took on these practices. They had a whole series of holidays. The holidays were based on episodes within Shabtai Tzvi's life, because the principle of it was literally like a new religion. The Muslims didn't really view them as part of them. The Jews never viewed them as part of them. Hitler, by the way, Paskin that they're Jewish, and he sent them to the gas chambers together with our grandparents and parents, and that was one of the major ends of this community. But it existed for a long time in Turkey. Their holidays were based, as I mentioned, on Shabtai Tzvi's life, and they made Kabbalistic understandings of everything that happened in his life. They interpreted his being thrown into jail, they interpreted his conversion, they interpreted his death, all in a Kabbalistic framework, is all part of the Messianic vision, because that was the principle. The fact that he had revealed himself, the Torah was now superseded by a spiritual Torah. The Torah that had existed, that we still have today, was a Torah for the world before the Messiah comes. Now that he's come, there's a new spiritual Torah that has been given. That's why many of the laws were changed. They had liturgy. It started in Hebrew. Eventually was switched to Ladino. There was an entire group of people, of Jews, who created this new religion, so to speak, based on the teachings of Shabtai Tzvi. This is after his death, and that existed for a very long time. You could look them up. It's just an interesting historical fact. If you do look them up, what you'll find is that the Muslims deal with them as Jews, and they were involved in all sorts of conspiracies together with Israel in the early stages of the founding of the state, which was in 48. So the early Zionist movement had ties. And if you want to know that they're still within the Turkey-Israel relationships, this was a powerful group in the upheaval in Turkey in the 1920s. Many of the reforms that took place, the modernization of Turkey, was led by this group. And this group was, Donme means a convert, it's a derogatory term for a convert. And there's these underpinnings of the Jewish relationship to them, because they all started off as Jews, even though as far as the Jewish world is concerned, they left and they're out and they're not really considered Jewish anymore. But there's a lot of interesting, and all that whole group stemmed out of Shabtai Tzvi, just to be aware again of the power of the movement, that there was these new religions, so to speak, that literally started from him. Just move that, just very briefly, that's all I want to speak about as far as the Dharma goes. There was another Jew by the name of Yosef ben Tzur. That was in Turkey. Immediately following the death of Shabtai Tzvi and Nathan of Gaza, there was this Moroccan peasant named Yosef ben Tzur, and he claims that Shabtai Tzvi was really Mashiach ben Yosef, and he is Mashiach ben David. Mashiach ben Yosef, of course, was supposed to die, which he did. And now this guy, Yosef ben Tzur, is going to claim that he is Mashiach ben David. Now, Yosef ben Tzur was very prone to the Middle Eastern custom of smoking hashish, and which was not viewed as a bad thing back then, but surprise of surprises, he had lots of visions and dreams about his being the Mashiach. Shortly thereafter, such episodes, he was regularly, in our normal terminology, high. And he dreamed a vision that he was supposed to travel to some land where he would meet one of Shabtai Tzvi's daughters, and they were supposed to marry, and in so doing they would cement the relationship between the Mashiach ben Yosef, who has now died, and Mashiach ben David, that he claimed to be. And thousands of Jews from Tunisia, from Morocco, from Algeria, followed him. You say, like, why would they follow him? And that's what the introduction that I had given before. It was so hard, particularly for the Murano Jews, the Jews who were of Spanish descent, who were hanging on by a thread, who had been rejected by their brethren who did not become Christian. And all of these promises of the Messiah, again, were built upon their ability to return. And this dream did not die easily. And when someone else picked up the banner after Shabtai Tzvi's death and said, we're going to do this, there were just literally thousands of Jews who followed. So we have in Turkey, there's an entire new movement that gets started. On the top of the African continent, we have with Morocco and Algeria and Tunisia. Also, we have all of these things. And when, you know, searching for this girl, he never was able to find her, believe it or not. And he dies without ever finding the daughter of Shabtai Tzvi. He never gets married. He just have thousands of Jews, another thousand who get lost and disappear, following after the dreams of the false Messiah. Those are just brief historical backgrounds of some of the characters which come out of the coattails of Shabtai Tzvi. Which leads us into the bulk of what I want to talk tonight, which is this Rabbi Yaakov Emden and Rabbi Yonatan Eibeschitz controversy. This takes place in Germany. So I just want to sort of paint a picture of how all different parts of the world are impacted by this. And this is going to take place a little bit later. You'll see in your notes, these two gentlemen, these two giants, Rabbanim, were born after the death of Shabtai Tzvi. They're born in the late 1690s, 1697, 1690. Shabtai Tzvi again dies in 1680. So this is 10 years after his death, which is 20 years after he's already become an apostate, they're first born. So by the time they reach their stature, their greatness, these two giants in Germany are living in a part of the world far away from Shabtai Tzvi, 30, 40, 50 years after his death. But this is going to continue. The brief synopsis, it's sometimes hard to keep track of the new names, so I want to give a brief synopsis and we'll go back into it in a second. Yonatan Eibeschitz was the Rav of the largest and most prestigious German community. There was a triple community. It was known as the triple community. It was known in Hebrew as Ahu, Aleph, Hey, Vav, and it stood for three different communities, Altoona, Hamburg, and Wandsbek. So there were three communities who functioned as one. There was a tribunal amongst them. There was one chief Rav. It was as if you had Toco Hills and Dunwoody and Sandy Springs. All were one large community. Just triple them all. I don't know how much larger it was. But it was like three communities who functioned as one with one chief Rav. It was the most prestigious position in Germany. And he was the Rav of that particular community. He had already established himself as a tremendous Talmud Chacham. Living in that town was a Rav by the name of Rav Yaakov Emden. Again, this is just a brief synopsis. Rav Yaakov Emden had a small little shul that he had gone permission to run. You know, so yeah, his own little shul. There was a chief rabbi. and he had his own little shul in his home, and Rav Yaakov Emden had taken it upon himself as a life mission that he was going to uproot all elements of Shabtai Tzvinik, the Sabbatean elements that existed. And in an episode that took place, which we're going to talk about, Rav Yaakov Emden, this who has his own little shul, accuses the chief rabbi of the town of being a closet Sebastian, and that will spark the largest fight, controversy, debate that will erupt throughout the entire Jewish world. Because it's not just like I say, even in our modern times, I would say, if someone in our community would say about one of our local rabbanim, he's a closet false messianic Jew. All right, so how big is Atlanta in the Jewish world? How big is this one rav and the one shul in Atlanta in the Jewish world? So we'd have to deal with it, but it wouldn't make waves everywhere. But if you could imagine in the times, not even so long ago, 30 years ago, where in America we had a posek of Moshe Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik, who was the posek of America, and someone of that stature is accused of being a heretic, that's going to make waves. Because the person who's accusing him is a giant, the person being accused is a giant, and he's not being accused of something small. And what happens is this is going to literally tear apart the Jewish world as everyone tries to sort out. Almost nobody could remain neutral. Because you either have to think he was a heretic or he wasn't a heretic. You can't say, whatever. It's not a whatever issue. Either he's our leader or he's a heretic. But it's got to be one or the other. And that will really do a number on our people. Okay, that's the basic synopsis. And let's take a little bit more of an understanding of this. All right, let's start with, let me just give you a story to give you a flavor of what's going on in the world at this time, because it relates to the parasha, so I figure it's an appropriate opportunity to do so. Rav Yaakov Emden, who we're going to be discussing, who's going to accuse Rav Yonatan Habish of being a heretic, had a great-grandfather. His great-grandfather became the Rav, I'm just blanking on his name, I had it, and I don't, his great-grandfather became the Rav of a town in 1666, which is in the height of the Shabtai Tzvi debacle. He received letters from two other people asking him questions. The following incident had taken place, and they both turned to him, the Rav of the town, to help figure it out. There was a Rav in a shul, and the Rav had given a drasha on Shabbos before Pesach. And the drasha that he gave before Pesach went along the following lines. There's a pasuk that we read a couple weeks ago regarding the Jewish people's exodus from Mitzrayim. Hashem speaking to Moshe says, when you leave Mitzrayim, one of the signs that will show that this is what's supposed to happen is Ta'avdun Bahar Hazeh Elokim. You will serve God on this mountain. So Marshem is speaking to Moshe, the burning bush, and saying, when you take them out of Mitzrayim, Ta'avdun Efe Elokim Baharaza, you will serve God on this mountain. The Rav darshened in shul, and he said, that's a strange language. Why does Hashem say in the pasuk that you will serve Elokim? Who's speaking in the pasuk right now? Hashem was speaking. He should have said, you will serve me. But instead he said, you'll serve Elokim. So he said, that's a very interesting language. So he darshened as follows. He says, Chazal described the sin that we're going to read about this week, the sin of the golden calf. And that episode, Chazal sometimes referred to the golden calf using the word Elohim, because the Jewish people said, Eilu Elokecha Yisrael, this is your God, O Jewish people. So this Rav gets up in shul and he says, what Hashem meant at the burning bush when he said that the sign that all of this is going to happen is that you will eventually serve Elohim on this mountain, you know what that was a reference to? There's a reference that God was foreshadowing that the Jewish people would dance around the golden calf shortly thereafter the giving of the Torah in Har Sinai. Now that is not a traditional or accepted understanding of that pasuk at all. That Hashem was foreshadowing that they would dance around the golden calf as if it was already a done deal and it was going to happen. Quite a liberty was taken with such a drasha. There was a member in the shul who got up and didn't go over to the Rav afterwards and say, I really don't think that's the right shot. I don't think that's right. Who got up and started yelling and screaming and making a macha and a protest, we have to throw him out, this Rav should be put in cherem, he should be excommunicated, take away his smicha, making a whole big to-do about it. And the question, they both send letters to this Rav, who happens to be Rav Yaakov Emden's great-grandfather, describing what happened, and what should we do? What happened? You know, this one complained that the Valabas is getting up there yelling and screaming. The Valabas is saying this Rav needs to be deposed of. He's not a valid rabbi. He's a heretic, the whole thing. So this story is recorded by Rabbi Jehuda Shachar Bekoded, who writes that if you think about it and put it into context, you'll see a very different perspective. Shabtai Tzvi became an apostate. And I mentioned there's this bitter decision that everybody has to make. How do we interpret that? What do we do with that? Is it real? Does that show that the whole thing is a farce? Or is that just part of the Messianic program? So those who wanted to make it part of the Messianic program need to explain that the graph of the Jewish people is not a smooth graph until you get the Messiah, but that there are lots of weird bumps along the way. And in that context, if a Rav got up in your shul and said, Hashem himself predicted, foreshadowed, told the Jewish people that there would be a golden calf, and you were on the campaign to uproot all vestiges of Shabtai Tzvi, you'd say, wait a minute, what are you saying? Are you saying that that was part of the program that was preordained, that our leader, our Jewish people, Aharon himself, would become part of an idolatrous practice? That smacks of sort of this apologetics to what's going on. Put that in the context of what was going on. The Shabtai Tzvi in Gematria was always discussed, and Gematria of Egel for the golden calf fit in together with Shabtai Tzvi, and there were all sorts of other allusions to that. And the question that's being asked is one of, this is what's taking place in the shul. What's taking place are drushas which have allusions to, can be referenced as understanding elements of Shabtai Tzvi, and people being very, very sensitive to that. That was Yaakov Emden's great-grandfather. His grandfather was a clear, established Shabtai Tzvinik. His father, who was known as a Tzvi Ashkenazi, who was known as a Chacham Tzvi, was one of the most vengeful anti-Shabtai Tzviniks. It's like hard for us to put ourselves in the shoes. Families were torn apart. The Chacham Tzvi, Rabbi Yaakov Emden's father, took it upon himself that he became known as a Kanai. He was a zealot as far as uprooting all elements of Shabtai Tzvi. He was also a genius. Part of being a genius, that I've heard this from Rabbi Wein, likes to use this phrase often in describing different types of geniuses. Some types of a genius, he says, don't suffer fools well. They can't handle it. So the Chacham Tzvi had that quality. He was a Rav in 18 different places. Because he was a genius, he said what he thought, and he ended up being in a lot of different places. But what his life's mission was, he was going to uproot all elements of Shabtai Tzvi from all of the communities that he was in. He has a son, as I mentioned, Yaakov Emden. Now, his name was not Ashkenazi because he served as a Rav in a small town called Emden, and this was often the case. That's how he got his name. Whenever you learn about European history, so much, like, as I was reading through this, I came across a city called Mannheim, and all the Rabbanim from there were called Mannheims and the Emdens, and Rav Yaakov Emden, as we learned, became known as the Yaivitz because his initials, the Yud for Yaakov Ben Tzvi, was the Yaivitz. He became known as the Yaivitz, so all the people named Javitz today are descendants from Rabbi Yaakov Emden and who's known as the Yaivitz. So the famous Javitz Center and other Javitz family we have all these names come from, all of these cities and places and names. So in any case, Rabbi Yaakov Emden was known as a Kanoi Ben a Kanoi. He was a zealot, the son of a zealot. He took all of his father's work and he went even farther as far as taking it upon himself that he was not going to allow there to be any elements of Shabtai Tzvi practices. Now again, he's born after the death of Shabtai Tzvi, and by the time he becomes a Rav, it's 30, 40, 50 years later, but it's still part of the Jewish world where he lives. And he was an extremely talented, he was a prolific writer. We have over 31 Svarim that he wrote on all sorts of topics. He wrote an autobiography. He wrote a Siddur. The Siddur of Rav Yaakov Emden is a huge two-volume Siddur in which he went through correcting many of the typos and mistakes that had worked their way into the Siddur over the centuries. He wrote a massive commentary on the Siddur. It's not a Siddur you can daven from. It's a textbook. But it's a textbook which was a massive encyclopedic work on the Siddur. And the way that he earned his living, he was a printer. Because he was not a... By the time he gets to this threesome town of Altoona and Hamburg, he was a printer, and he lived in town. He had applied to be the Rav in 1750 of the chief rabbi of these three, but he was passed over for Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz, which is going to add quite a lot of mystique to this dispute. He is now just a balabas. He's just a member of the community. He has his own little shul, and he is a giant on his own rights. He's the son of a giant. The Chacham Tzvi was one of the preeminent scholars of the time, and he is going to go about and try to take care of all the things that he could, that there shouldn't be any Shabtai Tzvi. He was involved in another major dispute, which is worth noting as well, besides the one we're about to talk about, and that is with the Ramchal. Ramchal is Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato. Anyone heard of the Ramchal, Moshe Chaim Lutzato? Household name in the yeshivas today. Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato's most famous work is? Seil Shisharim. Very good. The Path of the Just. Anyone who learns Musar in yeshiva or elsewhere in seminary will at some point come across The Path of the Just. It is the book, the Musar work. What he did in this work of Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato, known by his acronym, the Ramchal, there's a passage in the Gemara that discusses the great sage Pinchas ben Yair. Pinchas ben Yair, who the Gemara says in him was so holy that even his animals were holy and were able to determine the difference between their food, whether or not it was appropriately tithed or not. Pinchas ben Yair writes, if you want to know how to achieve Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration, follow these steps. And he gives you a list of 12, 13, 14 different steps. Being careful, acting with alacrity, purity, holiness, and he goes through what the list is. So Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato took that list, which are just words, do this, that, and the other, and expounded upon the wrote an entire book. This is what it means to behave with zehiros, with being careful. This is what it means to behave with alacrity. And he writes this book, which is, again, the centerpiece of the Musar movement 100, 200 years later, and is still today the work in all of Musar. The Vilna Gaon, the great Gaon of Vilna, writes that he read through this entire work for the first 10 chapters. He could not even find a single word which is extraneous in the work. It is just a brilliant piece. He writes in his introduction, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato, one of the most classic rabbinic lines of all times. And he writes in his introduction, I have not come here to write anything that you don't already know. Everything that I'm about to say you know, but because it's so common, you forget about it. One of the most classic rabbinic lines, and that's really the job of every rabbi in his sermon, every Shabbos. It's really not to tell you something, you know it already, it's just we forget, because it's so common. So you need to be reminded of the things that you already know. And sometimes you just need it couched in a sports story or something else. But it's really, the idea is you already know already. I'm not telling you anything new, it's just to inspire that which you already know. That all comes from the Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato, who wrote his entire book and said, there's nothing new in here. But it'll hopefully remind you and inspire you to that which you already know. In any case, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato was brilliant, he was a genius. He died very young, all of his works were written in a very short lifetime, but he was a nonconformist. He was a little bit different. He wrote poetry, and he wrote prose, and he was a great Kabbalist and a great Talmudist. He did not dress in classic rabbinic garb, and it was rumored that he didn't have a beard. I don't have any distinct proof to that, but he didn't fit. He didn't fit, and because of his Kabbalistic approach, he grew up in the Italian city of Padua, and he was banned from there. Excommunication was a classic tool that was used in post-medieval times, and as Rabbi, as I've heard from many times, I didn't hear it specifically, but other than that, one of the worst tools imaginable. If you want to keep something quiet, so just ignore it, and it goes away. You want to have everybody talking about it, ban the guy. Burn his books. Excommunicate him, and everybody's like, hey, what did he write? What did he say that was so bad? Best way to spread news is to ban it. throw it in the garbage and ignore it, and no one will ever know the difference. So he was banned from this place. He ended up in a bunch of different places. He ends up in Amsterdam as a lens grinder, where Rabbi Yaakov Emden was. And Rabbi Yaakov Emden goes after him as a Shabtai Tzvinik. And the reason for that, which is significant to us, is because he was different. When you're so concerned, when society is so burned by someone outside the fold of classic rabbinic behavior, so then that those sensors are so sensitive to picking up on something, that someone who doesn't fit becomes a heretic. Someone who doesn't fit the classic mold is already suspect. And that is really one of the great lessons of this, is to learn, and we're still suffering from that now. We're very, very tight-knit. Even like a community like ours is much less so than in New York. But we all suffer from it, and we all know people in New York who really suffer from it. And it's really remnants of, here are the lines of our camp, and if you don't fit in, maybe you're like way out. And to the great Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato, who has become a household name, who was the pillar of ethics, Mussar, development, was banned from one city to the next because he had a Kabbalistic bent, and Kabbalah is going to get a very bad rap after all these false messiahs, and he was a little bit of a nonconformist. And after his death, Rav Yaakov Emden wrote a quasi-apology in which he basically said, because he's such a great man, he knows that everything that I did was the shame Shemayim, was for the sake of heaven, to protect the purity of Torah. But you see what protecting the purity of Torah, it's a very careful line that if you're not within those parameters, you were suspect, so to speak. In any case, the main issue that Rav Yaakov Emden has with Rav Yonasan Eibishitz, who was born in 1690. His father died when he was very young, but he was recognized, Rav Eibishitz that is, as a genius at a very, very young age. By the time 1750, he's 25, he's already the head of the yeshiva in Prague, and he received permission to print the Gemara in Prague, which is a big deal because the Christian authorities there had never allowed a copy of the Talmud to be printed until he, through his genius and his relationships, was able to get that done in Prague in 1715. It had to exclude all the Christian references. There was always a debate as to certain proofs or disproofs from within the Talmud. So that's how we have. If you learn Gemara today, you'll find many things in brackets or in parentheses which have been taken out over the years and put it back in over the years, because depending on where the Jews were printing their Gemara, there were certain censorships which they had to be sensitive to, and things were taken out and then eventually put back in. But he already has some trouble. By 1724, this is 25 years before our story. In 1724, there are suspicions that arise that he is really a closet Sabbatean. And that is because a book came out. It was an anonymously printed book, and the book was clearly a Shabtai Tzvi Nick book. It was clearly espousing the belief in the idea that Shabtai Tzvi was indeed the Mashiach, and the fact that he became an apostate and that he died really is just part of the program, and this is what needs to be done, this and the other, and it was attributed to him. He denied it. He spoke in Yom Kippur on his shul at the Ne'ilah Drasha, completely denying all such claims, and not only denying the claims, but denouncing the entire movement of Shabtai Tzvi, saying that the whole thing was a falsehood and nobody should believe it. But, you know, as once a rumor gets started, pretty hard to put away. So that's already back in 1724. He's a relatively young man. He's a 35-year-old man, beginning his rabbinic career, and the rumors already began to circulate that he was indeed in the camp of Shabtai Tzvi. He continues on. He was a genius, as I said, a major Talmud Chacham. In 1736, he becomes the Dayan, chief judge in Prague. 1741, he becomes the Rav in Metz, which is one of the major cities. And in 1750, he wins the three-man race to become the Rav of this major three-pronged city in Germany, of Ehu, of Hamburg, of Altoona, and of whatever. That position is the crowning achievement. That's the end of your rabbinic career. That is, you're the biggest. That is the preeminent rabbinic position in Germany, and he was the preeminent Rav at the time. He begins in 1715, September of 1750, as we do today, right before the Yom Tovim. He takes over as the chief rabbi of this area. Right as he takes over, there is a terrible plague which breaks out throughout Germany, and it was particularly affecting women in childbirth, and women were dying in childbirth in droves. And as you can imagine, it created a massive panic in the region. Any plague would create a panic, particularly with women in childbirth. It was a serious deal, and nobody knew what to do about it. Rabbi Yonatan Eibeshitz was also a great Kabbalist, and there was an idea that exists in Kabbalah of writing what's called a Kamiya, or Kameya, depending on the Hebrew, Yiddish, Aramaic pronunciation, which is an amulet. And an amulet would be written on a piece of parchment, and there would be Kabbalistic symbols and words written on the amulet, and the person to whom it would be given would wear it, and it was to ward off, so to speak, evil spirits. It was to protect against disease and plague, and in this particular case, death in childbirth. Rabbi Yonatan Eibeshitz was a well-known amulet writer. He had done so for years in all of his previous stops in Prague, in Metz. When he gets to Altoona and Hamburg, and this is what's greeting him, when he gets there, he begins to write amulets for the women in the community to be able to protect them from this plague and death during childbirth. What happens is there were already a number of rabbanim who were still hanging on to the thought that the new chief rabbi in town was a secret Sabbatean, and they wrote letters to various individuals in the three communities saying, be careful, we still believe that he's the author of that Shabtai Tzvi book back from 25 years prior. Yonatan Eibeshitz dismisses it. He just says these are his enemies bringing up an old story. They're just rehashing old stuff, and it's not true. I have nothing to do with that. But meanwhile, people were looking at the amulet. And one of the amulets was opened by an individual who read it and saw in the amulet a reference to Shabtai Tzvi. And he brings it to Rav Yaakov Emden, because Rav Yaakov Emden was also, he was a giant, but he was just a rabbi of his own small little shul. And they show it to Rav Yaakov Emden, who was anyway on a life mission to rid all of the Jewish world of any remnants of Shabtai Tzvi, and he declares, this is for sure the writings of a Shabtai Tzvi believer. I mentioned Schneer Lineman, yeah. I don't think they worked or not, but I can tell you that the article that I read from Schneer Lineman is because a few years ago they found the amulets. There was as part of the story, the amulets were confiscated and written down by the local the official people who write things down? Yeah, the notaries. Excuse me, the official notaries in town, and they were all the five that were gathered, and they were notarized. And then sent to different rabbanim throughout the world so that no one can claim that these things were made up. Here they are, and they dug up in some old vault, someone was doing research on something else in the region, and dug up these notarized copies, and it was like this huge... This episode that we're in the middle of right now has continued to fascinate scholars until our day. Literally, until our day, that you could get a PhD, as people have, on this topic. So when they found the actual amulet... So Dr. Lyman, who's very big into Rabbi Yaakov Emden in this particular controversy, got a copy of them and wrote up a whole other article on it. So what was the thing in question? So there was a word in the amulet that Rabbi Yaakov Emden accused Rabbi Yonatan Eibeshitz of having a Shabtai Tzvi reference in that word. Shabtai Tzvi originally said, Rabbi Yonatan Eibeshitz, no, that word doesn't mean what you say. It means really it's just the Roshei Tevot. It's the head, the letters of a phrase of a pasuk. Let's say the Bereishis, Bara Elokim. So you would write Beis for Bereishis, Beis for Bara Elokim, Beis Aleph. It really, it's not a word. It stands for Bereishis, Bara Elokim. So I'm just making a bad example. So the word in question that Rabbi Yaakov Emden said is a reference to Shabtai Tzvi. Rabbi Yonatan Eibeshitz said, no, that's not what it is. It's just a allusion to this pasuk or that pasuk. And then when he was further pressed, he said, well, he really just was copying the way that he was taught by some great Kabbalist how to write. And then he eventually denied that they were his at all. And as it began to escalate, the situation began to escalate amongst the townspeople. The townspeople called a meeting in which they immediately shut down Rav Yaakov Emden's shul for accusing Rav Yonatan Haibishitz as a Shabtai Tzvinik, and subpoenaed him to a council. He didn't go because he figured the deck was already stacked against him because the people of the town wanted to exonerate their new chief. This is happening in February. He's been in the position for 5 months. Just shows up in town, hasn't yet fully unpacked his bags, and now he's got this accusation that he's a heretic. So they call a meeting, and Rav Yaakov Emden doesn't show up, and instead in his shul makes an official declaration that the chief rabbi is a heretic. And he's a Shabtai Tzvinik. The people of the town literally throw him out. They ban him from town. They give him 6 months to leave. Yaakov Emden writes letters throughout the Jewish world seeking support and sending them the amulet saying, look here, this is what he wrote. He's clearly a member of the secret Shabtai Tzvi party. Rav Yonatan Haibishitz, meanwhile, has been a Rav for 50 years. He has students and connections throughout the Jewish world. He begins sending letters out to the Jewish world to defend him. There were many, as I mentioned before, dating all the way back 25 years, who have always felt that Rav Yonatan Haibishitz indeed was the author of that book, and believe that he was in fact a Shabtai Tzvi believer. And so major rabbinic figures come out saying indeed that Rav Yaakov Emden is correct. Look here, the amulets, you see clearly from them that he is. Other major players are coming both ways, and the situation falls apart. I want to read to you a paragraph from, this is from Rabbi Schachter's dissertation from Harvard University. The entire triple community was split into pro-Emden and pro-Haibishitz factions. Now again, this is the chief rabbi, and he's being accused of heresy. So it's not just something small. So you have to take sides. Either he's your chief rabbi, or he's a heretic. There was no middle ground. Personal insults, physical fights, even street brawls became common between members of the contending groups. Local secular authorities and the Danish monarch were drawn by both sides into the conflict, as were leading rabbis from other Jewish communities in Poland, Bohemia, Moravia, Italy, Hungary, Holland, Turkey, France, Lithuania, Ukraine, and Palestine. Hamburg's police were summoned to quell disturbances. Local newspapers carried accounts of what had become a major cause célèbre for Jews and non-Jews alike, and the violence spilled over into the marketplace, fairs, cemetery, private homes, the synagogue, even onto the floor of Hamburg's stock exchange. Excommunications and counter-excommunications of people, as well as books, were traded across Europe. Proclamations, insults, threats, denunciations were hurled by one faction against the other, and the tension and bitterness continued even after Haibishitz died more than 13 years after the controversy began in 1764. The entire Jewish world became embroiled in, he is a heretic, he's not a heretic. Emden is jealous that he didn't get the position, Emden is defending of the faith. Which one is it? And the entire Jewish world becomes embroiled in this particular the area was under the Danish monarch at the time. So originally the Danish monarch kicked out Yaakov Emden and said that he was out of line and he had to leave. And then his supporters got his ear and he brought him back. And then he was kicked out. The governments were involved. It was an international affair that literally sprawled across the Jewish world. The questions, some of the major Jewish personalities in the time could do nothing. The Vilna Gaon, who I mentioned, was a young man, could do nothing to stop this. And Noda Yehuda, Rabbi Yechezkel Landau, was the leading sage, couldn't do anything. It just took on a life of its own and was one of the uglier events, because to the layman, what an effect you had were the giants, the rabbinic leadership, literally fighting over what was, in effect, at its core, the essence of Judaism. Are we being led by a heretic? Or is this real or is it a false accusation? But it can never be proven. There is no way for Rav Yonatan Haibishitz to prove his innocence, and there is no way for Yaakov Emden to prove his guilt. We even have the actual amulets now, and we still don't know. Interestingly, the Jewish people have exonerated Rabbi Yonasan Ibishitz. He, in Jewish thought, is not viewed as a Shabtai Tzvinik. In the world of academia, Jewish academics, non-Jewish, but from an academic perspective, he is hands down viewed to have indeed been a Shabtai Tzvinik. We're like, well, who was right? So, in the world of academia, the academics believe that the proof is overwhelming that he was indeed a Shabtai. His son, by the way, Rabbi Yonasan Ibishitz's son, came out of the closet, so to speak, and officially declared himself a Shabtai Tzvinik. And the secular academic world, book after book after book, believed with incontrovertible truth he was for sure a secret believer that Shabtai Tzvi was indeed the Mashiach, and it was all part of the divine plan, and we were just sort of waiting it out still 50, 60 years later, but that he indeed believed that that was the case, and that was his position. The Jewish people will quote Rabbi Yonasan Ibishitz and all of his books as totally valid, and he was not a, meaning, like, it's like the masses, the gut of the Jewish people felt that he was unjustly accused. He was the chief rav, he was the Talmud Chacham, and his works are all valid in Jewish life. In the world of academia, those who actually study, and he was clearly decided to have actually been a member of Shabtai Tzvi's party. What does it matter to us at this point? If you want to get a PhD, it matters to you because you'll have what to write about. But literally, books have been printed in the last 10, 15 years still about this topic. He was, he wasn't, is, he's not. But that is just part of what has gone on. Yeah.
He had to know that his accusation was going to tear the Jewish world apart even more than it had already been shattered.
This is where and why it's such a fascinating debate, because let's assume that there was clearly enough reason to assume that it might be true. I mean, again, modern scholarship has definitely decided that it was true. Let's just assume that there was enough reason to believe it to be true. You now have the chief rav of the most prestigious Jewish community as a heretic. Are you supposed to be silent, or are you supposed to upend and get rid of that? How do you go about it? It's like, welcome to the world of great controversies in Jewish history, because that's why you have one, because... A great title for it, it really is. Because that's what you literally have. You have the most powerful Rav leading the most prestigious community, and you have valid reason to believe that he believes in a movement which is heretical. So you can say, alright, well, no big deal. He's at least playing the party line. He's pretending. Or you say, and again, that's, I was trying to put into the context as to what the Jewish world was like for the 50 years following Shabtai Tzvi. We're going to uproot every vestige of this because it is destructive in itself. And I'm not here to judge one way. Your point is a valid point. That's why it became such a great controversy, because all of the Chashuva Rabbanim, there were many, many, many Chashuva Rabbanim, significant Jewish leaders, who took Rav Yaakov Emden's side and said, he must be deposed of. This is wrong, Rabbi Yonasan Ibishitz. He's a Shabtai Tzvinik. We don't tolerate that. And there were as many Rabbanim who said, he's being unjustly accused and this is the wrong way to go about it. And that's why we have controversies when there's two sides to an equation. What it did, and why we're still talking about it today, is because by the time they're done, the Jewish world is in shambles. The rabbinic authority is in shambles. The factions that are going to break up into the Jewish world are a result of a lack of belief in the rabbinic leadership. That such an episode can happen, that can literally every community, there were a bunch of who would lose their jobs, because if a rav took, every rav had to take a stand. Well, if your board held like this one, and the rav took a stand like that one, guess who was out of a job? So literally, throughout the Jewish world, for years afterwards, it just continued to reverberate. In Judaism, we have belief systems, and we have action. Would you sit in shul? I got this question from somebody 3 weeks ago. Somebody called me up, lives in a different state, and said he happens to be in an academic environment, and he says that our religious community is small. He said, one of the members of our community, who happens to be one of the few people with a nice voice, has confided in me that he doesn't believe anymore. He doesn't believe in God. He's married, but he doesn't want to ruffle any... So he's going along with the program, just doesn't believe it's true. He said, I'm uncomfortable during Musaf that he's leading. He's my shliach tzibur. He represents me. What am I supposed to do, he says to me? Am I supposed to make a macha? Am I supposed to make a protest and tell him that I don't care that you like davening and it's nice for you. You can't represent me. Would you want him to represent you? If in action everything was good, but he just believed that no one was listening to his words as he davened their musaf, and he's beseeching God for your help, and he doesn't really think it's going anywhere. Are you comfortable with that? You don't have to answer that question. I'm saying most Jews would say no. That I don't want somebody representing me who doesn't believe. I'm certainly not asking my halachic shaila about whether or not my meat's kosher, or whether or not I have a shaila in a mikvah, or whether or not I have a shaila in anything, to a rav who doesn't believe. So this is, it's the same, like, this is wrong. It's wrong. Those who felt we have to attack him with a vengeance because we're talking about the core of what Torah represents, and he's not it, and yet he's claiming to represent it. He's the rav of the most prestigious community. We can't tolerate that. Versus, well, it's just a belief. That's why it's on our class list of great controversies, because there's no solution. There was no solution, there is no solution, and it destroyed us.
Then they say that
that's worth it. Correct. This was literally, this was a controversy that, as you, it just, I think I'm agreeing with you, and it's true. This is why it was such a powerful controversy, because whatever a way you're going to look at it, someone's going to look at it as defending the faith. And as soon as you look at it as defending the faith, then there's no end other than defending the faith. And that's what we had, which is why it became really such a disaster. Let me just finish it with one little thing, then I'll take any other questions if you have. There's one other event that I want to mention. That was Yaakov Frank. There's another religion that got started literally at the same time as all of this is exploding in Germany, and then from Germany it ripples throughout the whole world. In Poland, a Jew by the name of Yaakov Frank claims that he's the Mashiach. It's like so hard to put ourselves in the... This is why sixth graders today, if you say that you're Mashiach, they say you're crazy. Because we have such a history of... Another one? Yeah, there was another one. Yaakov Frank claims that his name was actually Yaakov Leibowitz. He became known as Frank because when he would travel to different parts of the world, the Turkish Svardim referred to the Europeans who came over sometimes as... Frankis, so he became known as Yaakov Frank, and his religion became known as the Frankis. He claimed that Shabtai Tzvi was Mashiach ben Yosef, and he was now going to be the Mashiach ben David. You've heard this claim before. It was a common claim because of the ambiguity of the two Mashiachs. And he gathers a movement. It's hard to imagine how that happened, but it does. And there are estimates that he had over 30,000 Jews who followed him in combining. What he did was similar to what the Domna did. They combined Islam together with Judaism. What the Frankists did is combined Christianity and Catholic Poland with Judaism. And they combined it into a new religion until the Catholics there basically said to him, convert or die. And he completely converted over to Catholicism. He became one of the worst anti-Semites of the time. He would gather rabbis and make them go through all sorts of debates, which were humiliating at best. It is estimated that Poland has a tremendous amount of Jewish blood there, and a great deal of that is from these 30,000 Jews who were these Frankists who lived at the time in the mid-1700s, who also followed after them. I don't have much to say about them, but if you're interested in looking at it, I just wanted to point out the different movements that were created from Shabtai Tzvi and how much damage was done throughout the Jewish world. It, literally, in the 100 years after his death, still the reverberations, which lead to Kabbalah gets a terrible name, as I mentioned. Kabbalah gets a bad rap because almost all of the Mashiach claimants and those who followed him all had Kabbalistic leanings towards them, which allowed for, well, it's okay that you don't understand because it's mystic. And so Kabbalah goes underground. And as I think I mentioned this last week, what's going to happen is that a few short years later, it's going to explode back from under the surface into the form of Chassidim, which will be born just in the next century. After that, what also happens, as I mentioned many times, and this is one of the reasons why the Misnagdim, as next week's class, Rabbi Feldman is going to be teaching the Misnagdim and their response to the Chassidim. And one of the great claims that they had is that because the Chassidim were bringing back Kabbalah and this mystic approach to things, there was still this gut reaction from the Jewish people of, that doesn't work for us. Even today, many of the Chassidim are much more into talking about Mashiach than their non-Chassidic counterparts, and all of that is still a remnant of, we just don't want to go there anymore because we were burned so badly, so we blow even when the water is cold. And as I mentioned as well, the Jewish people, by the time this century gets finished, of the 1700s, as the Reform are going to move through, as the Haskalah and the Enlightenment is going to move through, we're just ripe for the picking, because they're just fractured, disillusioned with the authority of the rabbinate. All of the claims that you have, Jews in those days had as well, like, why can't we figure this all out? This has just been so destructive, so disruptive, and today, all the historians, when they talk about this episode, refer to it as really laying the groundwork for the state that we find ourselves in now, which is a fractured people, one who's suspicious of anything outside of the box, and we're remnants. We have the genetic spiritual DNA of the 1700s have come with us, and communities are founded upon them, and it just becomes part of the culture, and it's a remnant of this very, very sad time of the false messiahs. Again, encourage you, if you're interested in any of this, I find this just a massively interesting historical element of our people. You know, you can look it up very easily, Emden Eibeschütz. There's a ton of literature out there, and if you want the particular works that I've been quoting, I'm happy to send you those as well. But in any case, that leads us into next week's great controversy, which is going to be the birth of Chassidim, and then the strong response to them from what's known as Misnagdim, which just means to go against. As anything new was always viewed as suspicious. And that's where we really get there from. New means bad. New means evil. New means heretical. And therefore, there's always a gut response of anything new under the sun must be inauthentic. And we still have that very, very much today. And that is the period of our false Messiahs. So next week, Rabbi Feldman, Chassidim and Misnagdim. Have a wonderful day. Any other questions, I'm happy to stick around.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it, so that he can continue that site.